All right, dear listeners, well, we're back again for the first podcast of the new year. Happy 2013 to you all, and it is 20, not 2013, in case you're wondering.
Yeah, we're in the future now.
We are. We've made it there. Really? And today's show, we remember from last week, if you listened, that we did not announce a film to watch because this was going to be our first ever interview episode. We've got a filmmaker here in the studio with us tonight. His name is Mr. Nick Sanford. He was a guest host last week when we did our Tarantino retrospective on Jackie Brown.
We thought it was only appropriate if we were doing a director retrospective to have an actual director on the show.
So we are so glad to have you here, Nick, and we look forward to talking a little bit about the movie you've got coming out called Tempest Fugit. And just tell us a little bit what the movie's about.
Tempest Fugit, it's about a high school teacher who, I don't want to give too much away just because it's a short film and, you know, it's tough enough trying to get those out there, but it's about a high school teacher who finds a Ouija board in his attic and the things that come about from that horror film. It's the way I've been sort of trying to pitch it, or at least my idea was whenever we first started doing it, was we take something like The Shining, The Exorcist, and what if that was made like at the Amblin Studios, you know, the whole Spielberg thing. What if that was set in the Amblin universe with the kind of heightened sort of, you know, kind of version of suburbia.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Spielbergian aspects and, you know, visual cues you've borrowed for the film?
This particular film, not a whole lot because he's, you know, my end-all be-all director and all that, but, I mean, a lot of other movies, it's him ripping them off all the time, you know, the slow dolly end of someone looking at something off screen and all that, and lens flares and stuff like that. There is a part where the main character, he walks into the kitchen, and this is kind of in the last third of the film when the house gets all ghosty and everything. He walks into the kitchen, and he hears a noise from his vent, and we slowly start dollying in on him as he turns around. So it's the classic Spielberg, you know, someone turn around and look up at something off screen as we dolly in on them. There's that. A lot of it's backlit, which is kind of Spielbergian.
It is.
So, like, there's a conversation that takes place on the couch between, you know, the main character and his wife. They're actually a real-life couple in real life. That was a weird sentence, but they're a couple. It's a couple in real life playing a couple in the movie. You know, they're married and everything, so it's actually really, really cool. But they're sitting on the couch having a conversation, and you can't see their faces at all. Like, I mean, it's, you know, it's just so dark and just so intensely backlit in a lot of it.
We've talked about this a little bit, Nick. Full disclosure, listener, it's come up a couple times. Nick Sanford and I are friends in the real world, as it were. You know, special invitation to get on this podcast. It's very illustrious.
Yeah, be sure you add it to your CV.
Sir. I will.
But tell us a little bit about how your main actors, how you kind of ended up having a real-life couple cast in your film as a man and wife.
Well, this project came about from us needing to do a capstone project at Oklahoma City Community College, which, for those who don't know, capstone is your last film project, basically, before you can kind of move on. There, you know, graduate or whatever. And so, originally, we were going to do a little sci-fi film, which was really going to be, you know, Spielberg ripoffs all the way, because it was all going to take place at night outside, you know, so it was E.T. and Close Encounters. But the professor didn't like that script at all, so we found this one, this Tempest Fugit one, which I've been working on and off for years and years and years, and said, hey, you liked this. Remember when you liked this 2 years ago? Can we do that? So he gave us permission to do that. And so the actor we all thought would really, really work is this guy named Adam Hampton, who is also a writer and director, and he lives in the Shawnee area. And so we cast him, and then we were like, all right, who's going to play the wife? And for a month and a half, you know, we were stressing and pulling our hair out because we had to start shooting at the end of October. And, you know, you need a little bit of time for the actress or whoever, you know, is going to be the, I say whoever is going to be, it had to have been an actress, not an actor who's going to play his wife. But
he did Shakespeare.
Yeah, really.
Definitely would have played interestingly.
Yeah, but we looked really, really hard for an actress, and there were a few good, you know, there were a lot of good ones that tried out, but, you know, just none that, you know, kind of, they were either too young or, you know, too whatever, because he's 34 or 35, you know, so if all these 20-year-olds are coming in, it's just not going to look like an appropriate relationship. Finally, about a week before we needed someone, I called him up and said, hey, doesn't your wife act, or hasn't she acted in the past? And he's like, yeah. Like, why didn't you say anything before this?
I'm trying to cast your life.
Yeah, he's like, well, I didn't want to seem imposing or whatever. And that's not how he sounded in real life at all. But I'm like, well, can you try her out? You know, can she, I mean, would she be interested in trying out? And he's like, yeah, I'll ask her. I'm like, thank you. And so, you know, like an hour later, he's like, yeah, you know, she read the script and everything. She'd be interested in auditioning. And so we're like, all right, well, they live in the Shawnee-ish area. And I mean, it's just kind of a drive to get out there and stuff like that. And we, none of us had time to kind of meet at some point, you know, to try her out. So I was like, well, just, you know, tape her and then send us the audition, like over the email. He's like, all right. And so he called me the night that I was supposed to get the email. I was like, hey man, we've got it recorded, but I don't, you know, I can't get the email to work. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. All right. Well, how are we going to get it? Well, just, what's it recorded on? Is it on a camera? He's like, nah, man, I don't have a camera. It's on my, just on my iMac. So through the webcam? Yeah. So it doesn't look great? Nah, man, not at all. Okay. Well, you can get it to me by, try and compress it and put it on your phone and send it to me that way. 5 minutes later. Yeah, I can't do that. Okay. Take a video of it on your phone and then send it to me that way. And so to get this audition to me, he had to break this minute and a half video up of him recording a recording on a computer into like three different chunks so I could finally get it. But I got it and said, all right, she's got it. And so that's really, I mean, and there was
that's amazing.
And there was some, I'm blanking now, but there was some way that he could have sent it to me. Oh, for some reason, we never thought of him uploading it to YouTube, which would have taken 20 minutes and it would have been in a much clearer quality and I would have been able to hear a lot better, but we're both dumb when it comes to technology. So he sent a recording of a recording to me over a cell phone and it was compressed by the time it got to me and I could barely see her face, but you know, enough to know that
there's some transmedia commentary to be made.
Oh, sure.
I'm not sure what that is.
Well, we're just not very technically,
but I think oriented. That says a lot about the strength of performance of him. I mean,
exactly,
that
yeah,
core
yeah.
quality.
Excellent.
And that's not even sorry, I keep going over this, but
oh,
please. But there's a student, you know, that he has a conversation with at the beginning of the film, and I'm not going to go too far into what happens or anything, but there's a student that, you know, he kind of makes a connection with because his character, you know, has never had kids. And so the paternal anxiety is building up with him. And so he has this really nice talk with a student of his and then something happens to him later on. But he goes to meet the student's parents as well. And the two parents are the actual parents of the kid. They all came in to audition and they just all happen to be really,
solid.
Really good. So yeah. Everyone who's supposed to be related to each other in the movie is most likely related to each other, which is really,
interesting.
Yeah.
I actually had the benefit of, Sanford, needed some extras one day and I had the benefit of being on set the day he shot the scene where, Adam Hampton as a teacher, had a conversation with the student. It was really great to watch. I mean, mm-hmm. it was really impressive to see you guys just kind of moving. You had it's a well-oiled machine, and Hampton, I'm sure, you know, throughout this film, he will play very intense. He's just a real pleasant person.
He is, yeah.
I throughout the film,
not to me, but everyone else. Adam, if you're listening to this, I hate you. No.
it was fun to watch. It was interesting to get to be on set for that. I was glad to be a part of it.
So let's talk about the title for just a minute for our non-Latin speaking
audience
members.
Weird title.
Explain Tempus Fugit.
Tempus Fugit in Latin translates roughly to time is flying or time is fleeting or fleeting time or, you know, whoever is kind of doing it. But the whole point of that is the film is about a man who kind of develops this obsession with death, and he's kind of, you know, he's got this wife who's a really successful novelist in the movie, and, you know, he's got, you know, kids on the way and all this stuff is going good for him, but he just can't stop thinking about this other thing, you know, this Ouija board and the whole, I mean, you know, it's kind of death is sort of a big idea in his brain that he just can't let go of for some reason. Well, there is a reason, but I won't say it. But, and so the whole idea is, you know, stop wasting time thinking about things that are not important and worry about the important things because it'll eventually be the end of you. But, and so that's kind of his main thing is he's sort of, you know, possibly going to throw a lot of stuff away through chasing, you know, this obsession, which, you know, is another Spielberg flourish, you know, from Close Encounters. That's
right.
That's another, you know, I mean, it's a lot more you know, malevolent, this version of it, but it's essentially the same story as, you know, a guy, you know, about to throw away a bunch of stuff in pursuit of some, you know, crazy mm-hmm. dream, you know, and it's a young man who's still, you know, he's just about to lose, you know, the kind of youthful energy and all that. So it's like this one last, you know, obsession chase. But yeah, that's kind of probably the most Spielbergian of it, except, you know, this has, you know, like demons and ghosts and stuff like that, but it's essentially the same thing.
Well, Spielberg's gone there before too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, the context of all this filming and putting together this project is OCCC.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the program there?
OCCC, it's ran by two prominent figures. One of them, his name is Greg Mallott. He's been my professor half the time. You know, he teaches a lot of courses. I think he's taught me three times. Four. And he, you know, he's in charge of the capstone class, and he pretty much, you know, is director of the whole program. And he was a screenwriter, and, you know, they got him to come out and teach here, and he's written some Jackie Chan films, and, you know, I think he's done some script doctoring and stuff like that. And actually, he went to USC with a big hero of mine, Robert Elswit. He won the Oscar for Best Cinematography for There Will Be Blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's who he was buddies with when he was at school. You know, they made little movies together and stuff like that. So I'm always trying to get stories about him out of that, because, you know, I mean, that guy is a big hero of mine. And the other prominent figure there is Greg Fredrickson, who won an Academy Award for The Godfather Part II. And he also...
Little film, probably.
Yeah.
You might have heard of it.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, like, the greatest sequel ever made. But he won an Oscar for that. He produced the first Godfather and the third as well. He produced Apocalypse.
Forget that.
He produced Apocalypse Now, The Outsiders. He was a production manager on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So he's done a lot. And he brought his Oscar to class one day and let us all touch it. I barely picked it up, but I took a picture of it. I still got it on my phone, but. But and the story you guys were wanting to hear about, he at the end of our first day, me and my producer Stephen Patchen, you know, we're the geeks who are at the very front of the class, and we're, you know, eagerly soaking in everything he's talking about. And even just because I'm such a pile of shit, I actually wore a Godfather shirt to class.
Did you?
Just, yeah, he didn't notice it until
I'm on your team.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, it's such a. I mean, such a suck-up thing to do, and I kind of regret it. But, I mean, he thought it was funny. But I said, you know, after class, I said, hey, I just got the Godfather Blu-ray collection from Amazon. And he said, yeah, I haven't checked that out yet, but from what I heard, you can see me winning an Oscar on the special features. And then he walked off. So that was my introduction.
Now, he was associate producer, what was his actual credit on those films? Do you know?
It's kind of different, each one. I know... Good and the Bad and the Ugly, I think he was the production manager, but, and that's how he got into it, mm-hmm. was Spaghetti Westerns, but his credit on Godfather Part 1, and I think the reason he didn't win the Oscar for it was because it was associate producer, or there was some weird little loophole that he corrected by the time the second one came around, and that allowed him, you know, to get a spot on the billing block on the poster, and all that, but I don't know what his, like, credit is, but, I mean, he was there for all the crazy stuff, especially Apocalypse Now. That's, those are the most interesting stories. But,
God, I bet.
I mean, it was like the real-life Tropic Thunder. I mean, he said it was a mess. I mean, he said there were actual dead bodies that the production designer brought on, you know, to decorate the sets, and actual heads that they used.
Any film that has an entire feature-length, award-winning documentary about it,
its
nightmarish production has definitely got to have some good story straight from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
Outstanding. Well, tell us where you are in production of Tempest Fugit, and where we can find out more information about it.
Go to facebook.com/TempestFugitFilm. That's where we're kind of updating it. We haven't really updated it lately just because there's not a whole lot to do. We've got a couple little teasers up there that we're about to take down. But production right now, we've got one day of pickups and reshoots, hopefully, and then we should be done. And editing, I've already started. I mean, as soon as we, you know, every day when we were done shooting, I would take that footage and cut it together. But the film is rather long right now, and I'm kind of indulgent, and I've always edited my own movies, but, you know, everyone and their mom for years has been saying, you know, find an editor, someone, you know, to look at it objectively and kind of help you, you know, sort of, you know, really help trim the fat, because it's an indulgent film and the whole movie is really good. You know, all the performances are good. I mean, it looks fantastic. We've got a really good composer who's going to start scoring for it in about a month and a half or so, you know, and so you want to, you know, it's like, look how good it is. We need all of it, which is not, you know, because most audiences don't care how good it looks, or, you know, they just want a concise story. And so, we found an editor. We didn't really find her. We've known her for a while, but we said, hey, you know, you should edit this. So she's going to start in about a week, and I'm not going to touch it. I'm not going to be over there whenever she puts her first cut together, and then we're going to sort of, from there on, we're going to go through and kind of, I'm going to put back in my over my dead body moments, as I like to call them, but for the most part, you know, it's going to be sort of her kind of looking at it and cutting it together. So, one day of shooting left, and then, I mean, it's going to be a really, really intense day, because it's like another 7 pages that we've got to shoot in that one day, and that's, I mean, it's going to be insane, and it's some reshoots for the most part. And
outstanding, and then we'll be working on the festival circuit here in Oklahoma, and by the way, we do have film festivals in Oklahoma of Oklahoma-made films.
Mm-hmm. Trail Dance, it's in Duncan. It's a bit of a drive, but it's a good festival. We've gone there a lot, and it's always a lot of fun, and actually, he'll be mad at me if I don't plug him. Adam Hampton, our lead actor of the film, he wrote and directed and, you know, did everything for. It's playing, I mean, it's not the only movie he's made, but it's his most recent one. It's his best one, I think, or pretty much everyone feels. It's called The Unusual Calling of Charlie Christmas, and it will be playing at Dead Center. Or not Dead Center, sorry, Trail Dance in a couple of weeks. January 25th, I think, is, you know, kind of that weekend, whatever week that is.
Dead Center is another festival, also the 24-hour
It's kind of the
festival.
Biggie.
Yeah, Dead Center is, you know, it's pretty much the kind of the Sundance or whatever of Oklahoma, but, you know, that's kind of the big one.
So, we have an Oklahoma film industry, we really do, and part of that is because of filmmakers like Nick Sanford and what's the efforts of OCCC, and, you know, there's a lot of good stuff going on in Oklahoma. We're not a hub or anything like that, but there's stuff going on
out
there.
It's not a dead zone.
Okay, well, tell me what's some of the individual filmmakers that also influenced the making of this film.
This film, probably not filmmakers so much as films. The three main movies I told everyone to watch whenever we were getting ready to do this was The Shining, The Exorcist, and The Sixth Sense. That's kind of the Holy Trinity for, you know, that's kind of what we're going for. You know, like earlier Shyamalan movies.
I have to interrupt you. Yes. What is the Holy Trinity of horror films, dear listener? I would love your feedback
via social media.
If you had to put together a Holy Trinity for film, what would it be? So do let us know. Continue, sir.
That's a great thing
that you just said, and we want to inspire a little feedback.
I think of that stuff all the time. This particular film, it was The Shining, The Sixth Sense, and The Exorcist. And, I mean, if you watch the trailer, it's obvious where all those influences come from, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think The Sixth Sense influence is kind of what balances it out to make it not a horrifically vicious horror film, you know, because The Shining and The Exorcist are very, very vicious, and The Sixth Sense is kind of the Spielberg part of it, you know, because it's not a Spielberg film, but, you know, The Sixth Sense, I think, is a very Spielbergian film in a lot of ways, you know, with the whole father and son thing, and, you know, kind of the view of suburbia and stuff like that, but those are probably the three big ones. Some other movies I gave other people to watch were Cropsey, which was a weird influence to me for some reason. If anyone hasn't heard of it, it's a documentary and a really...
It's one I'm afraid to watch.
It's horrifying. And maybe it was just, you know, because movies,
one of those rare horror documentaries.
Well, yeah, I had never even heard of the concept of a horror documentary, you know? I mean, I've seen documentaries about disturbing subject matter, but the way they put that together was just, oh. And there's some... And I bought the soundtrack as soon as I was done watching it, but... And there were some tracks from that I used in the temp score for Tempest, which, you know, it's all going to be replaced by the time we put the film out with a legitimate score. But yeah, I mean, that movie really, really messed me up. I mean, and I've never been freaked out of a documentary like that. And I kind of watched that while, you know, we were sort of, it was last April, but in the back of my mind, I thought, well, if we need to do Tempest for our capstone, you know, this, oh God, just, you know, it was really creepy. Another one was The Village, which is a controversial, you know, thing whenever you're discussing film seriously. But that movie, again, was kind of the atmosphere, you know, sort of...
Unless you're correct and think it's awesome.
I love it. It's one of my favorite movies.
It has the rare distinction of being one of the few films I fell asleep during. It's difficult for me to go back.
To be fair, I didn't like it the first couple times I watched it. I've got this thing about movies where if there's a movie I hate, I'll watch it three times for some reason. And The Village is one that really, really grew on me.
Just to make sure you know if you hate it.
Yeah, exactly. Sense. Yeah, see, I don't know why I do it. The Village, like a lot of Shyamalan's movies, because I don't hate all of his movies. I didn't see Last Airbender. There are things about The Happening that I thought were of merit, you know, not are most there? Of it. The way it was shot and the way, you know, kind of the general concept I think is interesting. The execution for the most part was, you know, but, you know, again, the way it was shot and I like looking at Zooey Deschanel. Even Lady in the Water, I really, really enjoy that film. And,
I like
that movie. But also, that was another one that, it took forever for that to grow on me.
Dear listener, there has been some concern that I don't ever dislike a film. Again, Mr. Shyamalan,
Shyamalan. He's done a lot more than you, so
he has,
respect.
In fairness. The Happening, dear listener, has the distinction of being one of the few films I was absolutely furious after watching. That is a film I paid good money to see on opening night, and I was livid.
But The Village, I'm rambling, but back to The Village, you know, it was a lot of long takes again, you know, just kind of the way it was lit and scene composition and, you know, sort of atmosphere, kind of the eerie whatever, that was a minor influence. There was another Close Encounters was a weird one that I didn't really even notice until halfway through shooting, and I told Adam, like, this is kind of like Close Encounters, except, you know, it was like Close Encounters' nasty cousin. I think those are kind of the big ones that I sort of gave to everyone who would listen, you know, all the crew members who, you know, don't think I'm crazy and would listen to it, because almost all of the crew, you know, they're more talented than I am, so, which is why I'm glad I have them, because that's why the movies turned out so well. But this movie, Sam Calvin, our director of photography, his favorite director pretty much is Paul Thomas Anderson, who's one of my favorite directors.
Pretty solid.
And so, that being said, a lot of the movie, actually, now that I think about it, is really kind of, a lot of it we tried to do, if Paul Thomas Anderson made a horror film, how would he do it? And so, you know, there are some shots, you know, do what?
Dear God, do I want to see that movie?
I like
You know, and we weren't always successful, and that wasn't permeating throughout the whole shoot, because, again, some of it's Spielbergian, and I don't know, maybe the movie will look like a mess when it's all said and done, just because it's all these crazy influences coming into it. But a lot of the Paul Thomas Anderson thing is, you know, this real crazy extreme close-up on someone, and then we track around them with a room, and they keep going in and out of focus a little bit, you know, and which is intentional, and so that's, you know, and there's a lot of that in there. And just in general, you know, just kind of really long takes, you know, because while I was storyboarding the film, The Master came out, and I was a huge fan of that, and Sam Calvin was a big fan of that, and, you know, a lot of us were, you know, I mean, we loved that, you know. And I didn't like it quite as much as There Will Be Blood, but I still, you know, I was like, oh, God, you know, because there are a lot of those really crazy long tracking shots that just never seem to end. And because of that, it throws you off balance, because you're used to a certain rhythm in, you know, mainstream filmmaking, where it's, you know, cut here, cut here, cut here, cut here. And I'm not saying, you know, not just necessarily really quick cutting, but I'm just saying, you know, there's kind of a general rhythm that, you know, there are rules whenever you're cutting a film together, and your, you know, images, you know, the audience are, you know, they're perceiving the film the way you intended them to. And with a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson movies, and especially The Master, I think it was his most raw and just crazy and off-kilter film that he's made yet. You know, there's a lot of stuff that makes you nervous and sort of is kind of gut-wrenching in a weird way, just because it doesn't cut where you think it's gonna cut, and so, you know, you're thrown off balance, which is something we try to do with this. We try and keep the camera going a little longer than you would think it would, and it's not, you know, just on a static shot or something like that, but the camera, you know, moving the camera. Because there are a lot of shots that Paul Thomas Anderson does, you know, you're just transfixed because you don't know when it's going to cut. Like the big oil blow-up scene in There Will Be Blood, whenever he grabs, you know, his son and he's running away from the derrick, and you see it get smaller and smaller and smaller in the background. That scene goes on, or that shot goes on for like a minute or minute and a half or something like that, and it's just the guy running. So you're like, all right, what's going to happen? We tried to do that with this a little bit.
Outstanding. Well, you know, speaking of filmmakers and filmmaking, we're going to be talking a bit about filmmakers and filmmaking this week on the show for our little game of just your favorite filmmakers. What we mean by favorite filmmakers, I think, is those filmmakers whose movies, you may not love them all to every single movie, but if that name is attached to the movie,
you're going.
You're going. And I think we can be broad enough to go ahead and say that a filmmaker doesn't necessarily have to be a director. I'm sure we'll probably mostly list directors today, but I think screenwriters are of major importance. Producers are of major importance as well, and whatnot. So, but before we talk about our lists, we love us some listener feedback, and we have some this week about people's favorite filmmakers. Spike Alkire, a friend of the society, says that Lars von Trier is his favorite because he makes genre films like art house films, and that fascinates him. And I am fascinated by that answer, Spike.
That's a good pick. I like that pick. I'm not a huge Lars von Trier fan, but I think it's a solid choice. You know, he's definitely an interesting filmmaker. You have to admit.
Mr. Randall Bays is an Anglophile this week and says David Lean is his favorite because Brief Encounter is just a movie he can't let go of, and I think that is a very fair statement. And another film that is very important to him, or filmmaker rather, is another British filmmaker, Edgar Wright. He loves the way he makes those
solid
kid adult films, but he doesn't dumb down film culture, and really enjoys that. Jeff Fuller, several time hosts the show, loves him some Ingmar Bergman, and just the black and white cinematography. You know, Sven Nyquist, I guess he's Swedish. He is great in all of that, and yeah, very existential stuff. He really digs it. And Nathan Warden also comments that he likes Michael Mann. He, Last Mohicans, Collateral, and a close second would go to Mr. Ridley Scott.
Michael Mann's just a solid action director. I mean, you know, he's not a name you hear bandied about very much because of what he typically chooses to focus on. But in terms of craftsmanship, man, that is a solid action film director. I'm a big fan of his work.
Steve Vesley writes in Frank Capra, and he's great at getting at the heart, and I think it's a great classical Hollywood filmmaker, assuming that we're not still in the classical period, which we may indeed be. I think that's a great selection. And then finally, Kelly Milner writes in and says M. Night Shyamalan.
I like you. Yeah. I like her.
Yeah, look at you.
I'm a big fan of his.
And also, she gives a honorable mention to Mr. J.J. Abrams and Josh Whedon. And
I'm sorry, who?
J.J. Abrams.
No, after that?
Mr. Josh Whedon.
What Whedon?
Josh.
Who's
Josh Whedon?
I went ahead and just spoke too quickly. Yes, it is
Watch
a Josh.
Watch your dirty mouth.
That's okay. I'm not a big Josh Whedon fan anyway, so...
But well, like she said she would love Joss Whedon if he wouldn't keep killing my favorite characters.
Oh God!
There may be some Firefly love.
As a Whedon,
I haven't finished Firefly yet, so no.
It's not a Firefly thing; it is a Whedon thing. I mean, just looking throughout, I wouldn't call. I think Joss Whedon's made yay, but two films for the big screen. But he, you know, a long and storied history as a television show creator and showrunner. Man, as a Whedon head, that guy just loves killing your favorite character on just about every project he's ever worked on. It's kind of his thing. All the way from Buffy the Vampire Slayer to last year's Cabin in the Woods and the Avengers. I think that's a solid choice. You know, he's just made the two feature-length films, but I think he's going places, man. I dig his stuff. He's a great writer.
Mr. Bellstewart, do you have any feedback from Twitter?
We do have some feedback from the Twitter. This is a popular topic, I gotta say. Caleb Masters writes, occasional person writes, and also the host of
the BCD Flicksters.
BCD Flicksters.
American Christian University, at which I am currently an adjunct instructor.
Well, congratulations.
So,
he writes in to us. You can find him at Big Kale Kenobi 91, I believe. Yep, on the Twitter. He gives some more recent picks. He says, Christopher Nolan, Ryan Johnson, and Darren Aronofsky all rank high on my list. Scorsese is also worth a shout-out. Caleb, Scorsese is worth more than a shout-out, but solid picks.
I get
around.
What you're saying, yeah.
I do. A good friend of mine, at Blam David JM, David McIntyre, writes in Nick Sanford.
well done, sir.
A good friend of myself. He's a good guy. at I Am Wiggins, Andrew on Twitter, another friend of the show and student filmmaker at OCCC, writes in with some choices. I also agree with David O. Russell, Guillermo del Toro, Joe Carnahan, and Tinto Brass. That's a deep cut for you, Lisa. That's a joke pick. Tinto Brass directed the infamous Caligula and a host of other
nice
erotic one. Italian films. So good on you, Andrew. Frequent commenter on the show, Shane Arrington, at Shane, Corinth K1 on Twitter, writes in, Nolan, Tarantino, Fincher, Scorsese, Ridley, Kubrick, Chan-Woo Park, Soderbergh. No particular order. Love them all. All very solid picks, Shane. And that's what we've got coming in from the Twitter this week.
Well, excellent. Let's hear your list, Dalton. What do you say?
Well, dear listener, we'll work up to what you know is coming. I got to say, in terms of collaborative filmmaking, in terms of filmmakers you cannot separate into one particular person, I got to give it to Monty Python. The troupe as a whole, I think there's a lot of, in terms of writing, directing, all of these things, there's a lot of collaborative filmmaking going on, especially when you have that much work going on with improvising actors. You know, they've just made some of the most interesting, the most relevant comedy films that have ever been made, and I think that's really important to note. I do have to give a disclaimer. The bulk of my my list is going to be New Hollywood, which is typically defined as the mid-70s moving forward, and very Western-centric. That's not a, you know, a statement about the quality of film earlier in history or around the world. That's a failing on my part. My background is, as you know, in sociology, not film, so I'm a little less well-read than some of our other hosts on the show. I do want to mention one early filmmaker. I love Billy Wilder. He makes a great filmmaker. I mean,
solid.
He's a name you hear thrown around a lot because he is so solid and such an influential filmmaker. Scorsese, of course, kind of one of the front runners of the new Hollywood. Just a great filmmaker. Made some of the best films of all time, best American films of all time. Some of my favorite, personal favorite films. And I want to defend a much maligned, or the maligning of this filmmaker is a recent thing, but I want to stand to the defense of Kevin Smith. He is not the best director in the world. I will give you that. But that is a man that writes human characters, that writes fun conversations, that writes good films, in my opinion. He had a lot of respect in the early 90s, and I think over the last 5 years or so, there's kind of been a backlash against him, and I want to step to his defense. But, dear listener, all this in lead up to what you knew was coming. My favorite filmmaker is David Fincher.
Who?
It's directed a couple of movies you might have heard of. Man behind such works as Fight Club, Seven, The Game, Panic Room.
Oh, really?
In fairness, it's his one film I've never made it all the way through. I know, my favorite filmmaker, he has one film I haven't watched all the way through. But moving on, Zodiac, probably, you know, his best made film, The Social Network. I mean, the list goes on and on. He is a wonderful filmmaker. And after this episode, listener, I promise we're going to put a moratorium on me, Fincher, and Fight Club. It's done. As you know, Fight Club came up on our Office Space episode. My favorite film of all time. I don't know if it's his best film, but it's one that hit me at a point in my life where I was really first starting to get into film. And I think Fincher as a filmmaker has been, you know, influential in my life and a film viewer. I think he tells solid stories that really speak to the human condition in an interesting way that is realistic, without being pessimistic, I think. Required viewing for him, I would say, is what I like to call his obsession trilogy, Seven, Fight Club, and Zodiac.
Excellent, excellent decisions. And the Fincher rule is now
in effect. It's done, it's over. I'll shut up about it, I promise.
Mr. Nick Sanford, yeah. Top three filmmakers.
Oh God.
I know.
Spielberg's number one, Kubrick's number two, and then there are about seven or eight that are constantly circulating for number three, and I just, for the life of me, can't pick one. Because it's Martin Scorsese and Paul Thomas Anderson and David Fincher and Christopher Nolan and a million people, and I just can never, if I had to just say one... See, because this is my thing that I obsessively think about. When I think about favorites, I think, okay, my favorite movie, I decide that by deciding what's the one movie I'm going to take on an island with me if I can't ever watch any other movie.
The fabled desert island question.
Exactly, yeah, I think that's a good question. And so lately I've been trying to apply that to filmmakers. If I got one filmmaker whose collective body I can watch, and that's a tricky thing because there are movies that are in my top 10 favorite movies ever, that I'm not crazy about the rest of their filmography. And so that's a weird question. So if I just had to, it'd probably be down to Tarantino, Scorsese, and Nolan.
It's a solid three-way tie, I gotta say.
Oh, but I don't know. I really love Paul Thomas Anderson. I don't know. Eight of them.
real quick, if Brevity being the soul of wit, what is it about Spielberg that really, I mean, that kind of gets you going? I love Spielberg, mm-hmm. don't get me wrong, but I've always wondered that. You mean you've talked about
Spielberg
it.
Didn't make my list, so I'm curious to hear that.
Spielberg, well, it was just kind of a time and a place thing. I think the prism in which he views kind of life and suburbia and America and just, you know, I mean, just the world, really, because his films are kind of, you know, they've been stretching a lot lately. I don't know. It's just what has always worked for me, and it seems to work, or for a while worked for most of America, because, I mean, Jaws, E.T., and Jurassic Park are in the top 15 most attended films in American box office history ever. So that's, I don't know, that's just kind of what I've always gravitated towards. And E.T., you know, that's my all-time favorite movie, which I usually, like Dalton, is about David Fincher when it comes to that movie. I just never shut up about it. But.
See, the E.T. rule sounds like it'd be about something altogether different.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But, you know, I don't know. It's just he...
Sorry.
That was good.
That's a... Hold on. Hold it. Think about it. There you go. It took me a second.
But, you know, I don't know. I think the way he constructs stories, they're very accessible. They're not overly crazy and complicated, which doesn't make sense that Christopher Nolan's on my list, but or even Stanley Kubrick for that matter, because a lot of his movies are big puzzles, and I like that. You know, that's something that we tried to put into our movie, which I keep shamelessly plugging. But
that's what this show's for. So.
Hell yeah! Well, I know, but I keep saying we got Stanley Kubrick, Steven Spielberg, and we're going to talk about my movie now. But it's like, sound like a jackass. But I don't know, the way he just puts stuff together, the way he photographs things, the way he sees the world, that's what has always spoken to me the most. So I don't know what number I'm at now, but
that's outstanding. Those
are the big ones. And Alfred Hitchcock, I've got to throw that in.
You got to give him a shout out.
Hitchcock a shout. I'm going to start saying, I don't remember who said that, and I'm going to give Scorsese a shout out. I'm going to start saying that from now on, because that's a funny phrase, a shout out.
Yeah.
To you know, one of the most influential filmmakers ever.
Well, the single greatest artist of the 20th century.
Hitchcock.
Is Alfred Hitchcock.
Is that your pick?
I mean, yeah, he's yeah.
That's your pick?
That's my pick, yeah.
I know. I could have sworn you were going to say that. Kurosawa.
No, well, Kurosawa's on the list.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Kurosawa's on the list. Now, Alfred Hitchcock is the single greatest mainstream artist in 20th century. Mm-hmm. Actually, on a list of three, he'd probably be number three. Really, really like him a lot. Kurosawa, I put it number two, mm-hmm. Because he is the first filmmaker, the real first filmmaker, who did genre film as art film. Mm-hmm. We think samurai movie must be arty, but that samurai movies were just westerns of Japan.
Yeah,
That's all that they were, and he brought this pathos and energetic camera movement, expressionistic shooting. And Rashomon is a precursor to Pulp Fiction if I ever saw one.
Oh, non-linear filmmaking about a crime.
I got that on my instant queue. I'm going to watch it.
It's a great movie. Yeah. Great movie. And so, Kurosawa, you must get Hulu Plus for a week and just see a handful of Kurosawa movies if you have not already.
Dear listener, if you're looking to really broaden your horizons, if you like film and really want to dive into the annals of film history, Hulu Plus is the way to go. You know, I'm a Netflix guy, but Hulu Plus, you know, and their access to the Criterion Collection.
Mm-hmm. I got Hulu Plus a week ago.
They'll knock the walls
out your heart.
I'm digging it.
As far as world cinema, you know, movies with subtitles, I think Kurosawa is your most successful point of access.
Yeah.
I think by
far. And he went on to influence a generation of American filmmakers.
Yeah, we wouldn't have Star Wars. We wouldn't have Apocalypse Now, frankly, had it not been for Kurosawa.
Well, I mean,
we wouldn't have Taxi Driver. Mm-hmm. All of those movies.
Yeah, well, and you talk about, the, you know, samurai film being the westerns of Japan. You can look to America, the westerns. I mean, you look at John Ford, Sam Peckinpah, all these great west. You know, the directors of cowboy movies. I mean, the Magnificent Seven is a, you know, essentially a retelling of Seven Samurai. So yeah, no, definitely. Mm-hmm. But who's number one?
Number one, I tell you what, I can see every one of his movies from, and he's got so many different periods. And I think it's part of why I like him. There's a French period, a Mexican period, and then another French period. This is Louis Buñuel. I love me some Louis Buñuel because he's got art film. He's got more kind of just contemporary mainstream sort of stuff going on in Mexico. He does, obviously, he's one of the godfathers of surrealist film. And so it's very, very important in that way. And I really dig everything he does.
Buñuel is one of those filmmakers. I'm smart enough to know who he is, but not smart enough to have seen anything. What are the big three? What are the big three?
The Holy Trinity.
Oh, man, I don't know.
I gave you the Holy Trinity on my favorite filmmaker. Come on.
Here's what I'd say. I mean, everybody's going to say, you got to see, you know, one of the two silent films.
The three to get you in it.
You got to see, you know, probably L'Âge d'Or or Un Chien Andalou, his two silent features he directed mm-hmm. with Salvador Dali. Mm-hmm. Pick one.
Which one's the eyeball one?
That would be Un Chien Andalou. That's okay. The shorter one of the two. Probably the one to go with. Most people are not going to dig on that movie. It is on Netflix currently. So it is available there.
I lied. I have seen that one. So there you go. I got one check.
So I
haven't seen any. So
I don't love, you know, either one of those movies necessarily. But they're pretty great. Then I would say I'd say those two are one. Pick mm-hmm. one okay. and see. And then I would say Belle de Jour, the French period, mm-hmm. when he went back to France mm-hmm. With the amazing Catherine Deneuve, is a great, great film, and I think everybody should see that. And then his best movie, I think, is Los Olvidados, which is one of his less surreal films. I mean, Exterminating Angels, one that people would probably name for the Mexican period also, his return to surrealism. But Los Olvidados is... It's kind of a spiritual cousin to The 400 Blows
okay.
or to The Outsiders. Mm-hmm. And so it's street rat kind of kids. And it's really, really solid, solid, moving filmmaking. Important honorable mentions, as we all have. I mean, Kubrick, obviously, dig. I mean, how can you not say Kubrick?
Mm. Oh, yeah.
David Lynch is another big one that I really like
a
lot.
I do love that one.
And so there's he's an important filmmaker. And let me criticize O'Tourism for a little while, that director-centric kind of thing, even though I have a film director here.
No. I think about this a lot.
We spent a whole episode talking about it. It has to come up.
I got to say, three favorite filmmakers, two producers and one screenwriter. Carl Laemmle, producer at Universal. Mm-hmm. I love those monster movies from the 30s, and those are his doing.
Well, the 30s producers were directors, how we look at them now.
Yeah.
Steven O. Selznick was the...
Well, that was my next one.
Yeah.
Really? That back-to-back of Gone with the Wind, yes. Rebecca, and Duel in the Sun. I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
David O. Selznick.
Well, and I'll throw
happen.
Some names out before you do your writer. Ray Harryhausen, mm-hmm. who talked about Creature Features. Man, that's some crazy stuff. You know, I think he did eventually move on to directing, but primarily was an effects supervisor mm-hmm. early on. These films like Sinbad and Seven Voyages of Sinbad and... Jason the Argonauts, these really fun big adventure films from the early 60s, and just really starting stop motion, which kind of brought us eventually to CGI. I mean, yeah, it's not a one-man show. It is a collaborative effort, always.
No doubt. And I want to
committee storytelling is what a film is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And
Charlie Kaufman I would name, but that's not who I had in mind.
He's a great writer, though. Oh, God. He writes some great movies.
But Paul Schrader, Taxi Driver, yeah. Raging Bull, Last Temptation of Christ, great, great stuff.
Well, you mentioned, when I'm talking about David Fincher, one more time, get him one more. Two of my favorite writers are collaborators, Steve Zalian and Aaron Sorkin. Mm-hmm. Great, great. Aaron Sorkin, you know, working throughout the medium, film and television. I mean, it's a whole process, man. There's lots of people to thank and lots of people to, you know, these Oscar acceptance speeches go on for days because there are so many people mm-hmm. working on it, and you can't just single one person.
Yeah, they are collaborative efforts.
Absolutely.
And it's important to name
that.
Without
a crew.
And before I go, you know, as we were kind of doing our honorable mentions, I have to say Guillermo del Toro. I have to say his name.
Yeah.
Oh, because yeah. I love everything he touches, and that's he's solid.
So greatly looking forward to Pacific Rim.
Listener, you know, we have a teaching function here, and we want to talk about what that whole auteur theory, that Godard came up with, and...
it was him, wasn't it?
Huh?
It was
Godard. Well, not Godard. I mean, he's kind of the... Really
he's the name I always hear.
Bazan, I guess, is what you'd go further back there. All those guys who wrote for Cahiers du Cinéma, so you could do Truffaut, Godard, these Frenchies that did the New Wave.
Back in the 50s, 40s, as you go back further than that,
well, yeah,
French New Wave and...
Oh, the 50s, 50s.
There was a bunch of real smart kids in France who were no different than the guys working at your local, you know, Blockbuster family video in the 80s in America. They were just doing it in France before them. They went to a lot of movies. They started talking about movies, and they really kind of hashed out what became modern mm-hmm. film theory. That's the long and short of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they invented the auteur theory that we see films as art, and there's an artist.
That's why there's a lot of French words when you talk about movies with smart
That's
people.
Why we say auteur instead of author. And, you know, the reason mm-hmm. why we have a film genre called film noir, which is French, is because they identified it as a genre that the cats at Warner Brothers didn't even know they were making those kind of movies. And,
but man, they were glad they did when they figured that out.
Yeah, no, yeah, I mean, that's, again, greatest genre we ever produced in America. Yeah. I'm just saying.
I like detective stories.
That all is to say this, is that there's a lot of discussion about that. Not just about who's your favorite, why you like him, why you don't like him, but how you figure out who is really the author, whose voice are we actually seeing or hearing in a film. You know, Spike Jonze, I'm not sure he's an auteur, but when he works with Charlie Kaufman, I hear a voice, and it's his. And so I just think that's important to throw out there.
Well said. I like the way that is defined.
And so that's what we're looking for. So whose voice do you like the most, dear listener? Let's hear your list. Let's keep it down to about three because it's Twitter and it's only 140 characters.
That'll be good to limit you. We could have used 140 character limit on this episode.
Sorry, guys.
Oh, no. I'm just as guilty as you are.
This is fun times because we're on the show to talk about movies.
I love it.
And, you know, the thing is that, you know, there's art film, there's mainstream film, there's indie film, and, you know, rarely is even those things that aspire to be what they say they are as an art film, are they actually that? There's most of the time, Pauline Kael's right, most of the time it's good trash. And if we can't appreciate that, why are we even doing it?
Why do we bother?
I think Psycho is great trash.
Oh, man, it is. Oh, man, I maybe
it's delicious trash.
Man, I love Psycho. I've probably seen Psycho 100 times. I mean, I love the stew out of Smell of Hitchcock.
It's, for Dustin, for, and this, again, I'm digressing, probably get cut. This was something I was thinking about while Nick Samper was talking, though. Talking about obsessively.
No.
Stop talking.
I'm on other things.
Go away.
Can I kill you with a hammer? Good God. Samford is, and a lot of other aspiring filmmakers I talk to watch films a lot, watch the same 20 films a lot. Dustin, you kind of do a similar thing. You rewatch a lot of films, but I don't consider myself a critic. I consider myself somebody who likes to watch a lot of movies. I just like movies a lot. And I've talked to Arthur about this, and Arthur kind of, like I do, will watch a film and then kind of move on from there. If he really likes, he'll go back and revisit it later on. And I think that's kind of this interesting division between filmmakers and film consumers, at least the hardcore film consumer.
Critics.
Film buffs is what I'll say.
Mm-hmm.
I want to watch all of the movies. All of them. And I'll never do that because there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of, you know, available films on home media and for theatrical releases. There's no way. But I want to watch them all. As many as I can. And I think directors really try to, and I think you see this in the Sight and Sound lists, directors kind of approach films differently. The things that catch their eye a little bit more influence them. And I think that's interesting.
I never thought of it that way, but a filmmaker will watch, you know, because I've seen E.T. close to 100 times. I've seen Titanic, don't shoot me, close to 100 times. A lot. And the movie Signs is my number 3. And Jurassic Park, I've seen, you know, I mean, all those movies I watch over and over and over. And then I clash with Dalton. I'm like, you love that movie. Why don't you watch it more often? Because
there's a lot of movies.
There's a difference between filmmakers and film critics. That's a word I keep using. And you've actually swayed me a little bit recently in the importance of film criticism. Yeah, I know.
Oh, God.
Validation. Thank God this is...
Scream it from a mountaintop. Andrew McDonald, I hope you listen to this episode so you can hear that statement.
But, and not all film critics, because I think most film critics suck.
Well, there's a difference between criticism and reviewing. You review a product.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You criticize a work of art, and it doesn't come from a place of diminishing. It comes from a place of, let's turn our brains off.
Well, I would say, I'd give another category rather than, I would say criticism and review are close to the same thing. I think it's what Roger Ebert, Peter Travers, and Pauline Kael did was review / criticism.
Yeah.
My personal interest is film analysis.
That's a better way to put it.
Yeah.
I think
film analysis is important. The older I get, the less of a shithead I get. I'm sorry. But, you know, because, I mean, I'm a young man, and I'm very bullheaded a lot of times, and I used to think, film critics, and now, why do you need it? It's all for the audience. But I think you need a group of people who can dissect things. And, of course, the tricky part is, who's to say what's a better film than another film, you know? In the end, I think it's the audience. They vote with their wallets. But, you know, you need a group of people there to say, you know, to help nudge, I think, people in a certain direction. And I think that's what film critics and film analysts are good for. That's why I love Roger Ebert. I mean, the last couple of years he's gone a little... But, you know...
Four-star Roger.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when he gave The Happening 3.5 stars, that's when I was like, oh, pump the brakes, man. But, you know, like, listening to him talk about Casablanca and his enthusiasm for it and how he was, and again, you know, how he, even loving the film, he talked about its flaws and stuff like that, which I thought was great. I loved how he pointed out the fact, you know, who's there at the airport at the end to check their letters of whatever. I mean, what stopped Rick from getting on the plane and flying off at the end? Nothing. But it doesn't matter. You know, see, it's funny. Right. But he said a really cool thing, too, and I'm kind of getting
You know who stopped?
Here.
Rick? He didn't want to get on a plane with that broad.
But anyways, and he talked about, he's like, okay, if you're going to ask me what I think the best film of all time is, it's going to be Citizen Kane. But if I was trapped on an island and I had one movie to watch, it'd be Casablanca. And I think it's important for...
Best and favorite,
for
yeah.
smart, well-read men like him to be stating things like that, yeah. to help provoke people, because he was a very trustworthy critic in his heyday. I mean, he was a modern-day Pauline Kael, Pauline Kael will forever be the Hitchcock and film critics, probably, right. but I think it's important, and Dalton is kind of the reason for this, I think it's important for people to, not to say, this movie's better than this movie, because in the end, you know, I ask my parents about their opinions on films more than I ask film students, or I ask, you know, my cousins who don't get into film analysis or anything like that. I ask them their opinion more often than, you know, someone I go to school with traditionally, just because they can, you know, they're the ones that are paying for it. They're the ones that get excited about, you know, or not necessarily get excited about going to movies. They get excited about going to movies just simply for story and nothing else. Whenever we were ready for Django, we kept talking about, I can't wait to hear how the soundtrack's going to be, and, you know, all the snappy dialogue and all that, that most audiences don't pick up on, you know. I mean, a lot of them do. I mean, I think Tarantino's one of the few modern guys who does. But
the good trash genre cast audience certainly picks up on that.
Yeah.
I like to think they do. I like to think
Well, yeah, and I mean, and, you know, there are a lot of people, like my stepdad, he loves, you know, he really, really likes Tarantino a lot, and he really, really likes spaghetti westerns, and he really, you know, he likes stuff like that.
Because you should.
And, you know, there, and one of my uncles, who, he's not a film person by any stretch of the imagination, but man, he loves the Coen brothers. Mm. Those are, you know, that's one of the few people he seeks out, is the Coen brothers. And another podcast I was on, we were talking about Spielberg's influence. I'm sorry to get back to him, but he's one of the very, very few directors that my grandma knows who he is and knows most of his main movies, you know, but for the most part, just kind of the general audience, they don't look at things like that. They don't look, you know, they just, they know what they like, and they let them pull, you know, they let that pull them in. But I do think it's important, the older I get, that, you know, these things need to be analyzed, and people need to, how do I say it? Cars work. People like that cars work, but they don't know how cars work.
It's important for somebody to know how cars work.
Exactly. There we go.
I think what you're saying about people going in to be engaged in a story, and the thing is that movies are more than story. There's a lot going on in movies. There's a lot of ideology. There's a lot of reference. There's a lot of really teaching that happens.
And if it's good, they'll get it subconsciously, but they won't just be able to verbalize it.
And that's where analysis comes in. It's a chicken-egg conversation, because sometimes films are merely reflecting the overall attitudes of that public, and so it's a reflection there. And sometimes films are inciting some sort of change.
Yeah.
And so many times, unbeknownst to their viewers.
Or even the filmmakers. I think Jaws can be looked at as a statement about, you know, Americans' place in Vietnam, and I doubt that's what was on Spielberg's mind, but just because at that point in time, that's what was seeping into the, you know,
That's some good conversation there about just what we're talking about. We're talking about authors and film criticism and what makes movies great. Now, coming back again to these favorite filmmakers, I think an important question that has been near and dear to Dalton's heart is the idea of authorial intent. Mm-hmm. Dalton, can you tell us what you've been thinking about that?
Yeah, I can. I've said a couple of times on the show, author's intent be damned.
He has said this.
And I assume most of you can kind of pick up what I mean by that, maybe. For those of you who can't, though, I'll elaborate. I think most of you listeners can pick up what I mean by that, but for those of you who can't, what I'm basically getting at is, what is the importance of what the author intended with their work? Whether or not the author intended their film to be racist is irrelevant if the film is unabashedly racist. I'm thinking a film like Transformers Revenge of the Fallen,
That was pretty damn racist.
You know, whatever. That's a quick
Star Wars Episode One. Yeah.
Oh God, that's a film. Mm. That's a movie that was released. but what is the, you know, and I think those are two good examples of what speak to that. The author can talk all day about what they thought was important about their film. And at the end of the day, their opinion will hold some value because they made it. And you have to listen. If the person who made their, whatever it is willing to talk about it, you know, you should give that word some weight. But at the end of the day, and I think this kind of comes back to what Nick talked about a little bit with people voting with their wallets, and it comes back to what Dustin and I were talking about with the importance of analysis, is what do people take away from a work? What do they take away from it? And what consensus do we build through dialogue with one another about a film, a video game, a novel, an album, anything? What do we take away from that? And what becomes really important. I think what eventually becomes the most important is the conversations we have talking about work.
Can I interject something really
Absolutely.
Quick? All right, and this will be quick. Christopher Nolan, one of my favorite directors, obviously. I saw an interview he gave about Memento, and he was talking about, and this was done just a couple years ago, he was talking about when that film, it was either its premiere at wherever it was, or one of the early showings of it, you know, it was a packed critics house, you know, I mean, it was mostly critics in there watching it, and there was a Q&A or some sort of discussion afterwards where he was being interviewed, and he said someone asked him a question about, I don't remember exactly what, but it was something to do with the ending or some tricky part of it that the person didn't perceive the way Nolan intended it to be, and he corrected them on stage. He said, no, that's not what I intended, it was supposed to be this or that or whatever, and afterwards, his brother Jonathan Nolan took him aside and said, you can't do that. You just invalidated that person's experience of watching that film and their perception. And he said, from there on out, he has never, you know, he doesn't, he says once the movie's made, and this is just one side of the argument, but he says once the movie's made, it's the audience's movie. He said, mm-hmm. If you go in there, you're just completely, you know, in a less eloquent way of how he would say it, shitting all over their experience. You're basically saying what they're saying is wrong, which he only did once, and he said he was never going to do it again. But I think that's a good way to kind of verbalize author's intent, or at least for my mind.
Okay. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's great.
Yeah, because I really think, but sometimes, you know, I mean, I think once the movie's done, I think they should stay away from it. A good example to support this is George Lucas, but also, I mean, Ridley Scott, most of his good work, you know, some of his better work is director's cuts. So, who knows? But I like the way Nolan said it.
Well, I think when it comes to authorial intent, we're talking about an author's voice again. And the thing is that what we do not have is an essay spoken on screen by the author. What we have is rather a film shot by a different person, typically, who's the director of photography, with words that said by other people who are the actors, cut together by other people, and so whatever the author may be trying to say with whatever
projected
amount of control
by other people, and so on and so forth.
There is all these things that author may be trying to say, but there are other things being said as well. And so what the film says may or may not match up. It may not be intentional, and the author may be saying things unawares. There are Freudian slips, I think, that take place.
Yeah.
Or cultural slips, if you
of
will,
course.
That are going on as
well.
I think the intent of the author is something to consider, but it certainly isn't the end of the game.
Yeah.
And that's where Godard and, in America, Andy Serkis missed the boat. And again, the thing is there's a lot of things to say about movies. There's a rant
We've
I made
gone.
About things once upon a time.
Once a few episodes
Episode
back.
On a little movie called Creepshow. That is really the things that we have to say about film don't make them less fun. They make them more fun.
Yeah.
And that's why we do this, is so we get a chance to sit around and talk about these movies, what they mean, what they're doing to us, what they mean to do, what they didn't do, what they failed to do.
What they should have do.
Which happens on lots of occasions. And that's why we do what we do. And we want to keep that conversation going, not just here in the studio, but also with you all on social media. We're available via several mediums, one of them being Twitter. We're at good_trash. At Twitter, we're also on Facebook at facebook.com/goodtrashhonorcast, all one word. Also, goodtrashhonorcast.tumblr.com. We are also all available on Twitter. Let's go ahead and tell our handles. Mr. Dalton Stewart.
I can be found on Twitter at Dalton Stewart, STUART, one word.
Mr. Nick Sanford.
at @Nick_Sanford, S-A-N-F-O-R-D, like the TV show, but if anyone makes a joke, I'll find you.
It's true. It's true. It's the second time he said so.
He's done it before.
And I am your servant of cinema, Mr. Dustin Sells, which is Dustin_Sells, S-E-L-L-S, at Twitter.
I tell you what, this little interview episode definitely turned into an epic about film and the conversations we have about it. And you know what? I liked it.
Thank you for inviting me on this. This gave me
a great opportunity. We were happy to have you. It's two episodes
to be egotistical and talk about myself and the things that makes me excited.
It's been a pleasure to have you on, Nick. It really has been.
Well,
and
next week, dear listener, we will be returning to our regularly scheduled format.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin, do we want to talk a little bit about that?
The movie's going to be a movie called Lockout.
From last year.
From last year, 2012. And we're also going to talk about our top five films of 2012. Dear listener, what's your top five films from 2012? What would you list as the best films that the various film industries produced?
Or maybe not your best films, the best films, your favorite films.
Your favorite films. And maybe, just maybe, you could tell me what's the stinker of the year. I would just be curious to see what you say, because your stinker may make a list or two of top films, and that might be fun as well. So, look forward to hearing more from you and keeping the conversation going. We are the Good Trash Donor Cast, and we will see you next time.